Hey, Chris, how are you today?
Stuart, how are you today, my friend?
I'm doing fine. Unfortunately, not a good week for New York City in particular. Unfortunately, another New York City police officer lost his life, a 31-year-old Jonathan Diller, who was, doing his job and approached a vehicle that, quite frankly, was illegally parked, and it ended up resulting in him being shot and killed. And Chris, for me, it's been a while, quite frankly, and I don't know why this incident triggered me to go back. And I'm sure you remember arriving at Quantico, Virginia, the FBI Academy. And I will tell you, I remember making that 4.5-5 hour ride from New York City to Quantico. I remember getting off 95. It said Quantico Marine Base or Marine Base Quantico. You get off, you go on a beautiful scenic service road around the Marine Base, and then you pull up to this awesome building, and it's the FBI Academy. And, listen, I grew up in New York City, and quite frankly, the criminal element knowing about bad people or dangerous people, quite frankly, was not something that was part of my life. And I remember getting out and unloading my luggage. And I remember walking into the entranceway of the FBI Academy, and it was very, very busy. There were a lot of people there. But it struck me, and I remember this, it was very quiet. There wasn't a lot of conversation. And I went over to the desk, and I signed in, and you had to wait for someone to take your picture and give you a photo identification. So then they would escort you to your room, and then you'd meet your roommate. And of course, coincidentally, that happened to be you, Chris Pajota. But notwithstanding, I remember standing around in this awesome hall, and there were, all sorts of FBI memorabilia and, very interesting things. But walking down the hall, if you remember, there was the Hall of Honor. It was a memorial that was set up to honor those men and women who had lost their life working for the FBI. And I remember looking at each one of them and just, feeling like, okay, this is a person, a brother, a sister, a husband, a wife. And, reading or seeing this person, but still a little bit of a disconnect as to what the mission was of the FBI and really how dangerous the job could be or ultimately was when you take on that position of being an FBI agent. And Chris, do you remember a woman who came into our class maybe two weeks into the first agent's training? She had been raped and brutally attacked and tortured. And do you remember she was dumped on the side of the road and left for dead? Mm-hmm. And she came in and talked to us. And really her speech or her presentation was never, ever give up. And she talked about being on the side of this road in the middle of the night. And she obviously thought she was going to die. And she struggled and fought because she had kids. And she knew that if she surrendered, that, what would happen to her children. And I remember, and you may remember this, looking around the room, there wasn't a dry eye in the room of, 48 individuals, newbies. And I remember that was a first time, a sobering point in my life that I realized, man, the FBI confronts and deals and interacts with some really, really dangerous people, but still a little bit removed. I'm born and raised in New York City. And so you have this sense of street awareness, street smarts. And so, I still was like, I processed it, but still I had a lot to learn. And the reason why I bring that up is, and as you recall, as we went through this 17 weeks of training, and then of course, when you get out into the field, when you realize that there is a certain element of our society that's amongst us that truly is extremely dangerous. And the reason why I bring this up, Chris, is because this young man, really at the beginning of his law enforcement career, married with a young child, gets up, goes to work, probably is thinking about everything that you and I would be thinking about, and not even thinking about that this is going to be the last day on Earth, and is shot and killed. And is shot and killed by a career criminal, a thug, someone who is a piece of garbage, but not only a career criminal and a piece of garbage to the point where I think he was arrested 21 times. But can you imagine? He was shot in this incident. His Officer Diller's partner returned fire and shot him. And when he was transported to the hospital and in the process of them doing x-rays, this bad guy, this piece of garbage, they recovered what they call a SHIV, S-H-I-V, or better known as just a knife, a weapon. Can you imagine that you live your life and when you leave the house in the morning, you stick a knife up your rectum? So if in fact you're arrested and you go to jail, you have some form of protection. I mean, the fact that this person was out on the street is just unimaginable.
Well, I'll tell you what, as you said, we'd like to offer condolences to the family of the fallen officer. And what this is an example of how our society has different pieces and parts. And I hate to say it, but part of our society is that criminal element, that predatory element, where in the morning when you leave your home, you have to decide how you're going to conceal weapons inside your anatomy in case you have to use these weapons. Most people's lives don't consist of that type of thought process. It's completely alien to most people. Now, I've always heard it said that, you know, cops and criminals aren't that different, except for the fact that one chooses to do things on behalf of the good of society and the other chooses to do things on, to the detriment of society, right? You know, because you have to think like criminals to catch criminals. And this person you talked about, the person who did the shooting, from what I've seen in open source reporting, he had 9 felony arrests as part of his 21 arrest career as a criminal. How was he out?
You know,
just moving through society again with 9 felony arrests.
Well, Chris, and if I could, you know, and here's what amplified my anger and my frustration. So the governor of the state of New York, Governor Huckle, she had brought forth before the state Senate a bill to get tougher on retail crime, because in New York City right now, if you go into a CVS or a Walgreens or any sort of mom and pop shop, literally, the shelves are empty and you have to ask for the item. For example, razor blades, shaving cream, toilet paper. I mean, it literally is on lockdown. So Governor Huckle proposed a bill to increase as a deterrent against retail theft and those individuals that were committing these crimes. And as we group those crimes as quality of life crimes, notwithstanding that this is a no-brainer, right? So this is a common sense approach. My personal opinion, a little too late. I mean, this is something that should have happened many, many, many months ago, if not years ago. But at least she's turned it around. She's changed her stance. She's ready, at least seemingly, to take a tough stance on this. Carl Hestey, who's the speaker of the New York State Assembly up in Albany, he overrides it. He vetoes it and poo-poos it because he didn't like the fact that she was putting it into the budget. And I just said that there's such an urgency to get this thing passed. The fact that this person, this Assembly Speaker, Carl Hestey, is playing politics at the risk of endangering or continuing to endanger the quality of life for the people that reside in New York City and in New York State. Chris, what is it that I'm missing?
You know what, Stuart? I think you're right. And what this also leads into is not only do politics dominate everything over the health and welfare of our communities and our citizens, but also, and you mentioned New York State at the very beginning, it hasn't been a very good run here lately for New York State. And I think it also leads us to asking, there's a lot of people that have been leaving New York State, right? A lot of folks are departing the state, and everybody has to sit and wonder, why is it? And this is another incident that to me is a symptom of these things, the crime, I hate to say corruption, but how about corrupted process and corrupted institutions, right? They're not doing what they're supposed to do. The high cost of living, taxes. I mean, you can run down a whole list of issues of why people are leaving New York. You were a New Yorker. I mean, what do you think of that? I mean, what do you think of people just leaving the state?
I mean, look, Chris, when I decided to leave Manhattan or leave New York City, quite frankly, I did it because I got tired of the commuting. The traffic was just a nightmare, especially on a Friday. I remember, you know, being down at the FBI headquarters at, you know, 26 Federal Plaza, which if you calculate the miles, 12 miles to where I lived, and it would take me normally on a Friday night during summer hours when everybody was leaving early and going out to the Hamptons or the Jersey Shore, it was easily over 2 hours. In fact, if I got home under 2 hours, I felt like I was relieved of, right? And I finally said, this is craziness. I spend 3-4 hours in a car every day. What kind of quality of life is that to have? Now, with saying that, I never factored in crime. I mean, look, I was an FBI agent. I knew what the criminal element was. But, you know, the criminal element when we were there or when I was there, you know, you had drug cartels or organized crime. You know, you had groups that were in business and they were involved in criminal enterprises. But the reality was, as a person living in New York City, as long as you didn't associate within those groups, they didn't bother you, right? So, well, and that
there
was
were almost, yeah, but there were almost a sets of gentlemen's rules where they knew that they couldn't do certain things without drawing the attention of NYPD or the FBI or whoever.
Exactly.
So they were almost gentlemen's rules. I was not as fortunate, Stu. I was over in Newark, New Jersey, on the other side of the river, where we'd had no gentlemen's rules, and it was just, you know, human garbage everywhere and crime and street crime and you name it, we had it. But you had a more genteel crime environment to deal with.
I did.
You know, I'll tell you though. I just don't know how this is going to fare for the city of New York. And I think that they're doing some long-term damage to the soul of the city, to the soul of the state. And I don't know how some of these items are going to evolve. And then are they going to be recoverable when it comes to some of the crime? And now we have this new complexity brought in by the migrant populations. So the people of New York have got to make some decisions here, right?
Yeah.
They got to think about what kind of state they want, what kind of city they want, and they got to figure out how they want to live.
I agree with you 100%, Chris.
100%. Hey, as we're moving through some, and then we, you know, my thought process, I have this kind of circular thought process going here, but you know, thinking about the traffic, you mentioned the traffic in New York City. New York City is an island community. Of course, you know, tied to the mainland by bridges, which brings me to the Key Bridge, right? The Key Bridge incident, terrible tragedy. I'm sure everybody's well aware of it, so I won't go into any detail on it. But
let me ask you this, Chris. I got a lot of calls from everybody that I know across the board, even, you know, media outlets saying, hey, Stuart, come on, why does the FBI show up at a disaster like this? And so, Chris,
right.
You know, this is right up your alley. Tell our viewers why the FBI shows up.
Well, the FBI is part of a partnership among all of the federal, state, and local law enforcement and emergency management members. Whenever there's a large catastrophe, loss of life, even if there's a potential, however slight, for there to be an act of terrorism, the FBI will show up with its partners before they decide how the matter is going to be handled, who will take charge, and who will move into a support role. The FBI now is not in charge at this point. So they will become a good partner and they will offer support in terms of resource and consequence management.
Yeah.
And so when I was a special agent in charge and we had to do the same thing for certain things, we wouldn't be in charge, but we would show up to help row the boat, right? And get everything back to a sense of normalcy. So that's why you saw the FBI's special agent in charge for the Baltimore field office there, because he's part of that team to manage the welfare of the communities.
Well stated, Chris.
Well, hey, Stu, before we move on from the bridge, buddy, I just wanted to throw a couple things out there. People have seen this, but, you know, the Key Bridge has been in operation since 1977, right? The boat that hit it, just a large tanker, and it was holding, I think, 4,700 containers on the deck of the ship. Two of them went over that weren't hazardous materials, but they have 56 hazardous materials containers as well. So that's another reason the FBI would be involved, because they also look at hazardous material spills along with our DHS partners and other people like that. So that's another reason they would be involved. But, you know, I'll close with this on the bridge. I think everybody in that area better get ready for some inconvenience as we move toward the summer. Okay. And you're going to have the Port of Baltimore pretty much taken offline, or at least at greatly reduced capacity. You're going to have an impact in 95 traffic, right? I-95 is painful in that area, and it will just become more painful. And also, I think on maybe a secondary or tertiary impact, you're going to see some impact to commerce overall, because Baltimore is one of our biggest ports in the country, if not on the East Coast, if not across the country. Commerce, supply chain interruptions, and just civilian travel for the summer is just going to be brutal in that area. So,
but you know what would be interesting, Chris? When was it? There was was it in San Francisco after the earthquake, when they were able to put together or reconstruct these bridges within less than a year? And here is where I see our federal government asleep at the wheel. You know, you're a former military guy. You know, with the right assets put in place and with the right mission, you could assemble a team of people that could clear that harbor, preserve, and I get it, preserve it so that, you know, the National Transportation Safety Board, you know, gets what they need, you know, to conduct their investigation. Right. But clear that harbor of the debris and put that bridge back together, I would say within 6 months. And this is where it just kind of irks me, because, as you know, I'm the greatest fan of the United States, and this is where we fall short at times in national disasters, and where if we could just show the rest of the world that during these particular times when, you know, unfortunately, a bridge is struck by a cargo freight, you know, boat, that we can come together, put our assets together, work collectively, work uniformly, work seamlessly, and put this bridge back together and allow the, you know, free flow of commerce and traffic. Right. I listen to the politicians. I don't hear that commitment.
No, that's where the problem is, Stu. They're not focused on solving a problem or resolving a crisis. They're worried about political advantage and hedging in the political environment. They're not worried about solving the problem.
Yep.
So, hey, I'll tell you, let's move on to something a little more important. I understand that Joni Mitchell has returned to Spotify. What do you think of that? Her and Neil Young.
Well, listen, she bought into, you know, anybody who raised their hand or said, for example, I'm not going to submit to taking the vaccine or buy into the garbage that, you know, we need to stay at home and wear masks and hunker down and be in quarantine. Whereas for someone like myself, and my wife will tell you, you know, we were living in Florida, you know, quite frankly, we would talk to people up in New York and it'd be like, we're fine. I mean, like, we're not missing a beat down here. And here's a woman who really, you know, had to really eat crow. And of course, as you know, our government, the FBI, has come out and conceded and admitted that they colluded with certain tech companies, certain social media platforms to suppress our free speech, our First Amendment constitutionally protected right, to basically say, you know, shut up, don't speak ill of our government, don't speak out against, you know, mask, and, you know, just stay in line, be a sheep. Right. And now, of course, we find out, you know, and this person who I never heard of, you know, Fauci, you know, who was this person who was brought to the podium, who was going to save us all from ourselves. He turned out to be the biggest idiot in the world. And so, you know, now, you know, she was, you know, boycotting Joe Rogan and boycotting Spotify. And now the almighty dollar bit her in the rear end. And now she says, oh, wait a minute. Well, I need to get myself back online.
I'll tell you what. I admire that she sticks to her principles, but I guess she's been away for 2 years and, you know, you got to pay the bills.
And her bank account went down. So, you know, hey, how principled are you right now, Joni? Well,
that's what I'm saying. You got to pay the bills.
Amen.
Right? All right. We'll hit one or two more current event things quickly, and then we'll move on to some other coverage areas. Hey, what do you think about this search warrant for, musical star Sean Combs? I don't know what name convention he goes by right now. I'm not up on my street lingo is kind of rusty.
Sean Diddy Combs.
Okay. So I guess he was his home was searched by the Department of Homeland Security and their Homeland Security investigative branch. And, allegedly there were allegations of, you know, sexual assault, trafficking, all kinds of different things in the open source news media. Any other kind of illegal activity they could probably dogpile on them so they can get in. But here's the thing, just real quick for, you know, again, current events. A lot of folks don't understand the whole search warrant process and how it works. I'm going to give a couple of thoughts and then I'll let you close it out as, officer of the court. But, from when I used to have to approve or, you know, I was an affiant on warrants and when I used to have to approve them, you know, I used to tell my folks there were a couple of factors. One, what's the good faith in this? Why are we doing it? Right? It has to be some sort of good reason. And then there had to be a probable cause statement. There had to be an articulable sense of circumstances and facts that led us to believe that there was a crime committed and that crime, evidence of that crime could have been left in this home, location, what have you. And then you have to, you know, go to the magistrate, a neutral authority, to get somebody to look at this and give you that legal authority. You can't just show up. Now, there are exceptions, which I won't get into the search warrant, the search warrant exceptions. But those are the type of things that you had to look at. And then finally, you had to look in and say, what is the specificity or particularity of what you're looking for? Right? You have to be able to articulate these things. You can't go on fishing trips. It can't be a malicious search where you're just going there to harass and things of that sort. So once you articulate those points and once you have some experienced folks who can put together a good affidavit, then you would go and conduct the search, right? So there are many different search protocols, which again, we can hit at a different time. But as an officer of the court, Stuart, when you receive the other side of that law enforcement action, what are your thoughts on what happened with Mr. Combs?
Well, what I found interesting in this particular case, you know, my phone rang off the hook. I got a call from every news outlet out there, not only nationally, but internationally. And it was really interesting that a lot of people don't really understand the procedure and what it involves in connection with a search warrant and why a search warrant is not necessarily the same or doesn't rise to the same level of an arrest warrant leading up to, you know, where you would then ultimately prosecute the person. The most important factor in connection with any search warrant that is applied for, the information that is contained within the warrant, to some extent, cannot be stale or cannot be too historical. It must be fresh. And usually fresh means within 30 days. And by way of example is if you were in the presence of someone last year and you were in their home and you saw them in possession of a kilo of cocaine today, you know, a year later, the DEA could not go to that person's house just based upon that information and execute a search warrant to say that person, you know, is possession or he or she is a drug dealer. However, if that information was cultivated and then they would get the person to maybe make a call to that person and order up a sample of cocaine, that may be enough to refresh that historical information to then lead ultimately to a magistrate signing off on a search warrant. But Chris, as you and I both know, and this is really interesting that I found interesting this week that a lot of people don't realize this, is just because there is smoke doesn't necessarily automatically turn into that there's a fire. I've had many, many clients where they have been the target of a search warrant, and the government has come in or the state has come in with the good faith belief that the fruits of some criminal activity will be there to corroborate what they need to lead them to probable cause to then apprehend and arrest that person. Right. There are many times that that doesn't play out and that doesn't happen. I say, and I said this, you know, Monday when I was getting these calls and Tuesday, is that generally speaking, if there's enough information that they have not only to execute a search warrant and an arrest warrant, they're going to do both simultaneously. And clearly in connection with, from what has been told to the general public, that this case involves sexual trafficking. And just for the viewing audience to understand that, sex trafficking basically means when someone uses either threat, intimidation, coercion, or violence to cause someone to engage in sex for commercial purposes, that's basically sex trafficking. I do know, because I have pending cases with the Department of Homeland Security. And by the way, Chris, in the last couple of years, they have really elevated their game in connection with their expertise in this area, not only in sex trafficking and human trafficking, but there's also another component, and that's the money laundering component. Because anytime you're dealing with sex trafficking, generally right. speaking, people will pay in a covert type of way that you can't trace the proceeds. That ultimately leads into a money laundering investigation and ultimately a money laundering charge. But I just want the viewing audience to understand that, yes, just because, you know, the search warrants were executed in California and Florida, that by no means means that the government can and will prove or develop enough evidence to be able to charge Sean Combs or other individuals with right. sex trafficking.
Right. So, you know, you conduct a search and it's part of the investigative process. It's one of the
correct
more,
one of the tools in the toolbox.
Right. Right. So we'll see how that turns out. One
little thing that I want to throw out, because I was really surprised, you know, Combs's lawyer, you know, last night came out with a public statement and they released these photographs of allegedly the way the agents left Mr. Combs's house. And as you and I know, because I have been on hundreds of search warrants, that the first thing that happens, ladies and gentlemen, is the house is cleared and sweeped to allow the house to be rendered safe. That means we generally remove any of the people that are in the house. We bring them outside. We clear the house for any weapons. And so the house is secure and safe. Once that happens, and Chris, you know, you can touch upon this, we then bring in, and what I would call them, you know, crime scene investigators, part of our evidence response team, at least when we talk about the FBI, and they come in and photograph and videotape the location as it presents itself at the time of the execution of the search warrant. And why do we do that, Chris?
Well, like you said, when you clear the house, you're looking for hazards, right? You're trying to remove hazards to the law enforcement folks and or the crime scene technicians. But when you enter the facility, you take pictures, you take photographs on the way in, you photograph everything as it's found and everything in situation, you conduct your search, and then you take photographs as you leave so that you can show that there wasn't any excessive damage. You didn't leave a mess. You didn't harm any of the, the subject, for a better term, but the subject's belongings, or you didn't do anything kind of outside of that good faith, right? You weren't in there doing, things, hateful stuff in his place. So, but the fact is, it's procedural. Everybody knows how to do this and everybody does it, so they can refute claims such as those made, by, I guess, the attorneys for Mr. Combs. But, they're saying that they trashed the place. That is not practice. That, and anyone who does that is operating outside of professional standards.
And to that point, Chris, I'm not going to tell you it hasn't happened. I'm just going to tell you that I look at the photographs and I just say that looks like they were either staged, or that is the way the home presented itself at the time they entered the home.
Agreed. Okay. So we'll have to see how that one develops. Last item for current events, Stu. We got to roll. Let's talk about the unfortunate terrorist attack in Russia. And we'll touch it again on it in the national security discussion. But I guess the Russians were pretty diligent about picking up four subjects very shortly after the event, where gunmen entered a concert theater. I think it was a concert theater. And unfortunately, 130 people were killed through small arms fire. And the Russians conducted a very, very quick and effective investigation, found four of the people who they say were responsible for this attack. And the Russians obviously operate under a different set of law enforcement ethics and procedures than we do. The four people all looked a lot worse for the wear after the Russians gave them their initial questioning. So the only thing I would say is that, and you and I spoke briefly of it, but this is what people don't understand. This is part of the beauty of living in this country and living under the system that we have developed over the years of how we treat people here. The Russians have a different set of those morals and ethics and legal practices. And I would just say this, when our system is working correctly, we are all innocent until proven guilty. And the Russians probably maybe took a little holiday from that practice for this event. Yeah, yeah. So, Stu, what are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I mean, look, I saw the four individuals being paraded into the courthouse of wherever it was in Moscow. And quite frankly, it looked like they literally should have been obviously in ICU. I mean, they were beaten and battered and tortured. I mean, they looked like they were tuned up. And, Chris, the FBI has exclusive jurisdiction within the United States for our national security, as well as our counterterrorism mission. In fact, a lot of people don't understand. A lot of people think that the Central Intelligence Agency or the CIA operates here domestically. Right. That is not true. The Central Intelligence Agency actually is not authorized to operate here domestically. They operate overseas, internationally. And so the FBI has exclusive jurisdiction. Yeah. And I will tell you, and I have done many, many apprehensions in the national security arena, and I have done many, many apprehensions of high-risk individuals. And once that person is apprehended and the handcuffs are on, that's it. And just as you said, Chris, no matter how bad that person is,
right,
you maintain your professionalism, because number one is the easiest way to, take a great case and turn it into a case that has no life whatsoever is to do what the Russians do. And I remind, everyone who, somehow thinks that the United States has, fallen off course, so to speak. Even though our criminal justice system needs to be overhauled, and when I say overhaul, we need to put back deterrence, and we need to put cops back on the street. We need to give them the tools and the assets and redefine our mission statement that if you're a bad dude, we're going to take you off the street. We're going to give you due process. Right. But if you're found guilty, we're going to send you to jail, and we're not going to release you into this revolving door of justice. But I can tell you, and by the way, Chris, because I know, look, I remember last year in Memphis, the Memphis Police Department. I mean, talk about tarnishing that department. You know, there was an individual who had an encounter with multiple police officers, and they ended up beating him up to the point where they killed him. I'm not going to tell you there are not bad situations and bad cops, because there are.
Stuart, let me jump in there for one second.
Sure.
And that Memphis incident was a disgrace, right? Those guys weren't acting as police officers. That looked more like a street fight. Okay. That was not a law enforcement action. That was not a professional law enforcement encounter. That was a street fight. And there were allegations of some sort of interpersonal problems between the person, the victim, I guess you can call him in this instance, right, and some of those police officers. Yeah, you're right. That tarnished the image of the Memphis Police Department. I don't know how long it'll take them to clean that tarnish off the badge, so to speak. But I think what it comes down to is leadership and standards. There is no other explanation. What kind of leadership culture exists in that department that those people thought, those officers thought, that they could behave that way? And what type of standards were applied that they even made it through the system with those types of, I guess, behaviors and attitudes, where you don't have professional law enforcement activities? What you have is, again, that was a street fight. It was an assault, is basically what it was.
Yeah.
So terrible instance, but I do think you're right, though. By and large, our law enforcement is the best in the world. It's just that right now, I think we have so many societal pressures and points of friction that things have to level out a little bit so we can redefine how we're going to police our communities.
And let me just take it one step further. When you take a look at the video of the horrible, tragic shooting death of police officer Jonathan Diller, the bad guy, the guy, and I'm not going to mention his name because he's not deserving of that, so I'll just refer to him as a piece of garbage. The guy who shot Jonathan Diller, he himself was shot. And here is where the irony of all these people that want to say defund the police and the police are bad. You know, they rendered immediate medical assistance to that bad guy who shot and killed a brother police officer, transported him to the hospital. He received emergency medical treatment, and he's alive today,
right,
because of the New York City Police Department and the emergency medical technicians and the New York City Fire Department.
But see, that's where the professionalism comes in of the law enforcement.
Right.
It wasn't a matter of retribution. There was a law enforcement encounter. It was unfortunate, but they maintain their professional standards.
But Chris, so. I will bet you that if those cops on the street let that guy, that bad guy, bleed out in that car and he died, you and I tonight would be talking about the uproar of all these people saying, you see how bad the New York City Police Department is?
Right.
They let this cop killer die and bleed out on the side of the street.
Yeah, we have an imbalance in society right now that has to work itself out. And, you know, when you watch things like what happened today with that officer who was killed, I mean, I think those are unfortunate tragedies, but they help level out the conversation so we can get back to a good balance. We're not at a good balance right now. Let's move to, we talked a little bit about the Russia incident with the shootings at the concert theater. And, you know, he said there was 130 people were reportedly killed. But let's talk real quick about, they mentioned that ISIS took credit. Now, we don't know if that's true or not, whether or not they're trying to take some street cred for somebody else's activities, or maybe they are back. Okay, so either way, it's not good that they're involved. And let's talk about not the issue in Russia itself, because that's still being investigated by Russian authorities. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, you and I both work for the FBI. The FBI, as you said, is the primary national security function inside of the continental United States by executive order 12333. That FBI is the national security, counterterrorism, counterintelligence function in the United States. Let's talk a little bit about the threat escalation that this incident in Russia shows for the U.S. and other Western countries and our citizens, right? What are we looking at here as far as the threat of that happening here from the unmanaged border situation? What are you looking at on that, Stu? And then I'll offer an opinion after you comment.
Well, first of all, as you know, you and I have discussed, and you worked with Chris Wray, the director of the FBI. He is the director today, and you have a personal relationship with him. You worked directly with him. You directly reported to him. He, in the last year, has been banging on Congress's door, sounding the alarm that the crisis at the border has put our national security at the highest level ever in modern history. And certainly when you go back to looking at, 9/11, as high as the threat level was then, Chris Wray is telling you that, listen, that was then. We have a whole new complexity of threats, and we have all these people that are undocumented, and we don't know what their intentions are. And one of the things, Chris, and I guess because you and I have had the privilege, and quite frankly, the honor of being special agents with the FBI, and I tell people this, you have no idea what is really out there and what is going on 24 hours a day with respect to the management and mission of the FBI. When you don't hear about the FBI or you don't hear about anything blowing up, ladies and gentlemen, and Chris, you interrupt me or tell me when I got this wrong. The FBI is doing their job perfectly. And what drives me nuts is that people who kind of say, why do we need fences? Why do we need borders? We're the land of opportunity. Ladies and gentlemen, there is a real threat to all of us. There are people that are coming into the United States that want to barbarically kill us. And they are in preparation. They're in planning. They're already maneuvering and positioning to have this happen. And this idea that, La La Land just drives me nuts.
I'll tell you what, Stu. I think we're a victim of our own success as a society. We have built an exceedingly safe, high trust society in the United States over the years. And we have a very professional law enforcement infrastructure. We used to have a fairly competent government at the federal level. And people here have had the luxury of living in that very, very predictable status quo environment for many years, so that they don't remember that the world outside of the United States and maybe outside of the UK or a few other, the world is a very dangerous place. There are many bad things going on around the world. There is conflict, warfare. There is modern day brutality that people don't believe is true. And, as you've said on our previous shows, now you've traveled extensively outside of the United States, and so have I. And, you get to see glimpses of this when you go certain places. So I think what's happened now is that the United States, people in the United States have become very particular on how they want their lives secured. They want security by convenience and security on demand. Yeah. Right? And that's just not how it works. That's not how it's ever going to work. And what I used to tell people, if you want to define security, it's easy to do. It is a layered application of inconvenience and consequence. That is what security is. And it's put together by people to make people feel better. That's all it is. So if you want to steal something from my home, I'm going to lock my doors and windows. I'm going to get a dog. I'm going to put an alarm system in. I'm going to create those layers of inconvenience. The consequence is if you still come into my home, I either am going to defend myself or I'm going to call the police. And then you'll be taken to jail or you'll be injured, you know, in a confrontation. So it's not a hard concept, but I think people in the United States have gotten a warped concept of what security is and how it is applied. And I just hope we can get back again to a balanced discussion on how do we want to secure our communities from the evolving threats that are coming into our country that are we are allowing to form in our country because we don't want to offend people. And we have this, what I consider to be a very toxic sense of inclusion, that we're willing to include criminals and terrorists in our society so that we don't offend people. It's insane.
Chris, could you ever imagine that the president of Mexico would say, I know our people who are illegally entering into the United States, we're not going to take them back at all. But then he renegotiates his position, says, no, we'll take back our illegals, but you got to pay us $20 billion. I mean,
you know,
Chris, that's great. To any person, listen, and by the way, I haven't said the email address, so forgive me. Online,
right. Go ahead, lay with it out
Stuart
there.
And Chris at gmail.com. Online with Stuart and Chris at gmail.com. Yes, sir.
Stu, is it on point?
I think it's on point. I'm sorry. I'm pointing.
Okay.
You know, everybody's going to make fun of me because when I get crazy and get so emotional because yeah. I'm passionate about this. But like the president of Mexico, right. Who's not in any way denying my people are there illegally, but he's saying, if you want me to take my people back who entered your country illegal, you pay me per person. Is that not crazy town?
You know what? It's insane that we even had that discussion. It shows how far the United States has fallen from world prominence. But you know what, Stu? Our current administration will do it because it's just money. They'll just make some more. Doesn't matter. Well, I think we can get them back, Stu. But I don't think we can keep them out because the government doesn't have the political will to do it.
Yeah.
So moving them out. They'll just be back in a short period of time.
And by the way, wait, before you go, because I know people are going to hate this. I love Mexico. Vacation there. It's a great country. And I'm not picking on Mexico. I'm just using it as an example because it's an easy example. But, you know, whether it's, you know, any country whatsoever. And certainly now you have, you know, China, who is now utilizing this pathway through the border to exploit our weakness, that is a real concern of mine because of what's going on in the world.
Well, people are sleeping at the wheel, Stu. That is the strategic threat. Of course, criminals, gangs, and terrorists moving in. That's an immediate tactical threat. The Chinese and some of our other international competitors are staging a strategic threat for us, and we have become weak and distracted, and we're not doing anything about it. Hey, let's move into another area that I know you'll want to talk about a little bit. Let's talk about, this is kind of a rearview mirror piece here, but a lot of people saw the footage last week at the checkpoint in Texas where a group of migrants rushed a checkpoint and overpowered the Texas National Guard folks that were there, tore down our concertina wire and the fencing, and they bum rushed pretty much the checkpoint, and our guys really couldn't do anything about it. Mostly male, right? I didn't see all the women and children in that crowd. I missed them all if they were there. And here's my concern, though. That was televised around the world. Now, if people didn't think the U.S. has become a paper tiger before, the cartels and gangs and terrorist groups and everyone else sees it for what it is. We're not serious about our own border security anymore. We were unwilling to use force to repel that incursion. And
Chris, let me interrupt you. Do you remember just a couple of years ago, the Custom and Border Protection agents who were by the Rio Grande, they were on horseback. Do you remember them? Do you remember the scrutiny, and they fired the guys who were lassoing the people, and they said, oh my God, that's, you know, outrageous behavior, outrageous conduct. I mean, look, Chris, the world is upside down. This issue is so crystallized and so obvious, but when you have, you know, the inability to protect our national security or protect our borders. And I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, listen, if 100 Americans lined up in Moscow or lined up on the Russian border and tried to invade Russia through their border, do you think there'd be any one of us who would still be standing? Or do you think all of us would take a couple of rounds?
I don't think they would be as receptive, right?
Come on.
Here's the thing, though, and this is just something I would like people to think about. You have a group of undetermined, unknown foreign nationals. They rush our military people and run by them, trying to make it through our checkpoints. What if those people were wearing military uniforms and just didn't have guns and just ran right up on our guys and ran right past them?
Listen.
Would there have been a different response if they were wearing military uniforms? I don't know. But my thing is the lack of political will on behalf of our federal government is a disgrace. It's a stain on the honor of our nation right now. And the elected officials involved in this, they're not fit for their positions.
Yeah.
I want to make something really clear before people start assigning blame to the National Guard soldiers. As you said, those people are there under a strict set of rules and rules of engagement. And they're there more to be monitors of the situation. They're not there to, you're not seeing Humvees parked with 50 cal turrets and everything else. They are there as a presence. You know, on the force continuum, what's the earliest and first part? It's presence.
Yep.
That's what they're there for.
Yep.
It's not the fault of those National Guard soldiers. So I hope no one thinks that any criticism that we might offer for the situation and how it was handled is directed toward the National Guard soldiers. They did what they could do,
Chris, do you realize
based upon
their
rules of engagement.
And they didn't even unholster their weapon in a way to try to get them to turn around because maybe they'd be intimidated by the use of deadly force. Those guys on the border, our Americans, are in a standout position to the extent they can't even draw their weapons in a use of, you know, strength.
Yeah.
Chris, we have 3 minutes left.
All right. Okay. Hey, then let's do your thing, Stu.
Oh, boy.
Speed round, buddy.
Oh, no. Here we go. All right.
All right. Here we go. We got some numbers to live by. 4 minutes and 27 seconds. What does that mean to you, Stuart?
That's a good mile run, which I would never have been capable of succeeding.
You're right. That would be a great mile run, but it's not. It doesn't have anything to do with running. It is the duration of the solar eclipse. We have a total solar eclipse happening on the 8th of April.
Okay.
So the last one happened in 2017. The next one will happen in 2044.
Okay. Now, what do you tell the flat earthers? What do you tell them?
You know, you can't tell those guys anything.
All right. Okay.
All right. How about this? 985 feet.
985 feet. That's over three football fields. I don't know.
That's the length of the ship that hit the key bridge. The ship was called the Dolly.
Okay.
But that was the length of the Dolly, 985 feet long ship. So if anyone's guessing, like people are saying, well, how could it have caused that much damage? It weighed 80,000 tons.
The length of three football fields. That's pretty long.
And 80,000 tons moving in that direction.
And it doesn't have brakes.
No, the brakes don't work so good in the water.
Okay.
Here's another one. 370.
370. A poor SAT score.
That would be a poor SAT score. However, this is a little bit more impacting. That is the number in 2023. That's the number of naval ships that China possesses. 370 naval ships. At the beginning of 2024, the United States has 292.
Wow. Okay. That's it.
Now, here, just to build a little context, estimates by 2030, the United States will have possibly close to 300 naval ships. China will have 435 by current DOD projections.
Wow. Almost 2 to 1. If you're looking, it's crazy.
And if you're looking at strategic power and who commands the oceans, you can see we're not heading in a great direction.
Amazing.
Last one, Stu. 5,580.
Almost a mile. Almost close. Feet in a mile.
You know what? That's close, but no.
All right.
It's the number of nuclear warheads that the Russians maintain in their stockpile right now. 5,580. By comparison, the United States has 5,244 as of 2023. China has reportedly between 440 and 500.
Wow. Okay.
Nuclear warheads. So, you know, looking at some of those strategic numbers, again, things aren't looking great for us on the future strategic front. So something to think about. But hey, I know we're running out of time. Let me run through the gratitude and then you can have any last word on this one, Stu. But as always, we want to thank everybody who keeps society moving and functioning every day. And that includes our law enforcement, first responders, military. And again, you see what the value is of all of our rescue and EMS folks at the Key Bridge tragedy. You know, our medical folks, power, sanitation, construction. And we do want to give our condolences to the families, loved ones, and friends of those who perished at the Key Bridge tragedy.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we'll wish them the best and be strong for themselves and their families. So, Stu, I'll defer on anything else and leave the last words to you, my friend.
No, just tell our listening audience On Point with Stuart and Chris @gmail.com. And look, keep the emails coming. I got quite a few interesting emails during the week. And listen, it's not going to hurt our feelings. Some of them made our feel good. Some of the people said there was some cringing. But, you know, quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, if I make you cringe a little bit, hopefully at least you may think that we, Chris and I, are being honest with our positions. And by the way, we don't in any way believe that we know it all. We just want to give you an honest perspective of where we have been in our lives, and so that we could perhaps make you better informed to live your life in a safer and more loving manner. And that's what it's all about. And so, Chris, my brother, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, Stuart. And we'll catch up again here shortly. And I look forward to doing another conversation next week.
All right, buddy. Be well.
All right, man. Thank you.